Hi, this is Matthew Kale with 1620 Talk on Millennium Grown Podcast Network. Today we have a special edition. We are broadcasting live from the National Cannabis Summit in Denver, Colorado. With us today we have Sean Kiernan of Weed for Warriors. Weed for Warriors Project is... Hello, Sean, are you there?
Hey, I am. How you doing?
We had some temporary technical difficulties there, but I'm not quite sure exactly where we cut off, but I was just introducing you, Sean Kiernan from Weed for Warriors, I believe, and tell him a little bit about the organization, but really you should be the one to do that. So Sean, like exactly what it is, what is it that that Weed for Warriors does?
Yeah, Weed for Warriors started in 2015 by Kevin Richardson. Started off basically helping vets in California, Northern California, gathering and donating medicine to veterans. And now what we're doing is taking Weed for Warriors on the national level to advocate for the access of cannabis for veterans who would like to medicate with cannabis versus the VA's pharmaceutical cocktail.
And, you know, of course, most of the viewers of this show know why cannabis is important for veterans and in their healing process. But specifically, what drew you to the cause? What was it that stood out to your in your mind?
Well, I think it's my own journey from the military to dealing with many of the demons you get after serving overseas. My use of both pharmaceutical cocktails to try to deal with the issues that I had and have, and then also then exploring other means to include cannabis. And I have found personally that cannabis works a tremendous amount better than any other solution that I've come across. And I've basically tried them all. And so, you know, when I also lived in San Diego, I spent time in the VA hospital there and met quite a few returning soldiers from both Afghanistan and Iraq who had seen multiple tours and saw how the VA was approaching this issue of PTSD and war trauma in vets. And I have to be honest, it horrified me. And it horrified me in a way that kind of got me going back in 2012-13 into pursuing activist work and helping people in my area. And then it went national when I reached out and I met you through Dr. Sisley. And we fought, you know, her unjust termination at the University of Arizona. We all fought to get funding for her study, and we continue to fight to try to get that study ongoing.
And, you know, for me, at this point, the study is important. I definitely think for the furtherance of medical science, but really what we need is immediate action by our government. There's obviously a gap in our healthcare.
Correct.
In which you and I can access cannabis in legal states, but the vast majority of veterans across the states can't.
No, absolutely, that's absolutely correct. And in fact, one of the reasons we joined with Kevin Richardson at the Weed for Warriors, so you know, I came on board and helping him, and we're running this thing, turning it into a national platform, is exactly that. Which is, we have the study funded. That's proceeding, although there's some hiccups along the way. And the bigger issue is, while this study studies cannabis with veterans and with PTSD, you know, treatment-resistant PTSD, we're losing, on the conservative side, over 8,000 veterans a year. And in reality, when you look at the study where it says 22 vets are killing themselves a day, it's an incomplete study. And what do I mean by that? Only 21 of 50 states contributed data to come up with that number. 29 didn't. They either didn't have the information or it wasn't available, and they didn't want to share it. And out of the 29 states, two of those states, including California and Texas, which represent over 20% of our entire country's population, let's not even talk about they tend to be heavily veteran states, you know, where they're skewed higher than the just the population ratio. You know, you get to a number, if you extrapolate that out into the 1670 a day range, and then you start getting the numbers that are, you know, closer north of 20,000 a year of veterans dying from suicide. And we don't have that number. And for what reason we don't have that number, why no one's asked, well, okay, what are the numbers from the other 29 states so we can get an accurate handle on this thing? Yeah, I would love to know, but that's kind of where we live. So that's, I think, your segue into why we're focused on the Weed for Warriors is getting out the message that cannabis helps, cannabis is saving lives today, and getting out the message that many of our brothers and sisters don't have access to it because they live in a state that either doesn't have a medical marijuana program or it's so restrictive that it's fundamentally not helping them.
So how is Weed for Warriors Project actually addressing the issue on a daily basis in their own communities?
Yeah, okay, so we have chapters all across this country, and we actually, people to know, we put on hold our chapter growth while we, you know, figure it out from a growing pains perspective, but we plan on opening a lot more chapters even before the end of the year. So I suspect when we get back from this tour we're about to talk about, we're going to make a major push because our chapters and our feet, our boots on the ground are the most helpful. So let me give you three examples of things Weed for Warriors is doing to make a difference. One, the most recent one and most interesting one was, you know, us as veterans with PTSD understand law enforcement is not always our friend. And that doesn't mean they're not good people. It doesn't mean they're not trying really hard. It doesn't mean they don't have a dangerous job. What it means is when they come into a situation with a veteran who's having an episode or, you know, something's going wrong, their reaction to how they handle it many times exacerbates the issue. So what we do is we had a veteran who is a member and friends with one of our California chapter presidents in Sacramento. He was out in Sacramento. He ended up getting basically thrown in, locked up on a 5150 hold in the VA system out in California. And it was a nightmare in itself. That's a separate story. But they kept him for a while, over a month, I believe. When he got out, he lived in Florida, so he went back. We got a call from family. He had kicked out his wife and children from the house, and they were very concerned about him, and no one wanted to call the police. So we were able, within an hour, to get veterans to his door to check up on him, veterans who understand the situation. Veterans tend to mean he was a lot less defensive when they showed up, when they say, hey, this is the police, are you okay with guns drawn, because they're scared.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of vets that said, hey, we're, you know, hey, meathead, we're a bunch of veterans here. And they go, like, whoa, and we're able to check on them right away. We were able to stabilize a situation that could have gone worse. So those are just some things we do. That's one example that happened in the past week that I was involved in at 2 a.m. in the morning getting people to his door. Second, one of the stories, Chris Lewandowski, that I know you guys have talked about. Chris Lewandowski is a Marine veteran who was 100% disabled, being discharged out of Oklahoma. He had a domestic violence incident. Police show up at his house. No marks on either his wife or him. They don't want to press charges. The police take it upon themselves to do a search, get a search warrant to search the house. They found 9 plants. They claimed 9 marijuana plants. It turned out later that it was 6. 3 of them were tomato plants. And less than an ounce of flower. And they charged him with, I mean, it was a cultivation with an intent to distribute, but in Oklahoma it carries up to life in prison. So what the Weed for Warriors Project did was it leveraged its network. We got lawyers involved on a pro bono basis. We also got the press involved, and the press was actually, according to even the district attorney, very overwhelming in allowing them in dismissing the felony charges and turning it over to what's called Veterans Court, which usually Veterans Court is something for veterans when they get into situations that the courts allow the VA to handle it from an administrative perspective. So these vets end up doing a year or 18 months of PTSD treatment, a lot of it in-house, and you go through it, and if you successfully complete it, they do dismiss the charges so the vet doesn't have a record, it doesn't hurt his employment, et cetera. So that's the second example. And I'll just bring up the first thing. And the first thing that Kevin did was absolutely wonderful is they started a mutually beneficial corporation in California and ran a, you know, their donations out of it. They got donated medicine from growers and farmers and, you know, dispensaries who would donate medicine. And in return, they would distribute that medicine at barbecues on a monthly basis to veterans who needed it. And most of these vets, you know, were anywhere from PTSD vets to triple amputee vets who count on this medicine that could run in the $400-$600 a month range. And the Weed for Warriors Project is donating it free of charge to those veterans who show up.
And that touches on one of the major issues, I think, with PTSD in general is the fact that for one reason or another, veterans, when they get out of the service, they are either isolated by the system or they self-isolate. And in a lot of ways, that causes or exacerbates most of the problems of PTSD and traumatic brain injury. And just the fact that you offer them cannabis, it gives them an excuse to get out of the house, and it gives them an excuse to get around some other vets which they trust and build some camaraderie, build some actual social skills, some coping skills to be able to deal with their issues on their own. And that's a crucial part of this puzzle that I think is overlooked by the vast majority of veterans cannabis organizations out there that you guys are actually addressing.
You couldn't hit it more on the head, Matt. I mean, you know, as someone who's been through the system, as someone who's seen a tremendous amount about the system, as someone who had the money to extricate himself from the system when, you know, it helped me, I think it's absolutely horrendous which is going on. And you touched upon the isolation of the vet, and that occurs not only from self-isolation, but the self-isolation occurs because the vet's been through it. And what do I mean by that? First of all, mentioning you're a vet, everyone slaps you on the back, thank you for your service. But beyond that, there's very little done by the population in any town or city other than dog and pony shows and so forth. What we have is a system where we can't be honest. We can't be honest with our doctor, and it doesn't pay to be honest with anyone else. It doesn't pay to be honest with who do I talk to, because if I tell you what I really feel and real think, you're going to lock me up.
Yeah.
If I tell you now, by the way, I'm medicating with cannabis instead of your all the crappy-ass pills you're giving me, you're going to take benefits away, and you're going to disallow me to partake in some VA programs that I may need. So what we learn is we isolate ourselves because it's in our best interest to have that wall up and to have that guard up, because the government, the VA, and to be very honest with you, most people out there run out there and say, I'm a vet with PTSD. See how it goes, they smile, thank you for your service, and walk away. And so there is this great stigma that comes to it, and that is, I think, where the isolation comes from. It just does not pay. You can't talk to your doctor. I can't be open with my system. It even doesn't pay, as many of us probably know, to talk about it openly with family, people you should be able to trust. So the isolation is real. The isolation is there. And you're absolutely right. One of the things we try to do is we allow these chapters to have a free range of things they can do. We had a chapter, they do, you know, a paintball. Every month they do a paintball game. You know, they have a barbecue. They're there for each other. What do I mean by that? I get a call from, you know, one of our chapters. Hey, we have a gentleman whose wife lost his job. You know, we were able to give him a $500 gift card. Stuff like that. So those are things that, you know, it helps to know you have – a group of people who can advocate for you, who understand, because there's nothing I couldn't call you, Matt, and talk to you privately on the phone that I feel I couldn't tell you, because you've been there and you understand it, and vice versa. But that's where it stays. So we have to be our guardian. We have to be the people who take care of ourselves, because it's obvious the system isn't going to take care of us. President Obama's not going to take care of us. The VA is not taking care of us. It doesn't mean they're not doing wonderful things or not trying, but there's a systemic issue here that goes beyond any one individual's concern, that vets on the ground are not getting help, and we're not having an open, honest discussion about this, because at the end of the day, if we're losing anywhere from 8,000 to 20,000 vets a year, and we're 7% of the population with 8,000 or 20% of the suicide, and we know it's a lot higher than that, we have a major issue here that nobody's addressing, and they're not addressing because they probably don't want to know the answer, because that would require us to spend money.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is a money game. Although I honestly, I think that the VA should probably jump on board with the cannabis thing as a money saving measure. The amount of drugs that they hand out for PTSD and other conditions that can be treated with cannabis is staggering, and the amount of money it requires to hand out those medications, that's also staggering. Our country right now is swathed in debt. We should be looking for ways to curb this spending, and cannabis is a pretty common sense measure to do it, right?
I think so. It may not be for everyone, but I think, like you said, I think if listen, Canada does it. Canada gives grams every month free of charge to veterans. Israel is giving marijuana to active duty soldiers coming out of combat. So it's not that the science isn't there. Too many times in this country we allow propaganda to run the show because we don't have the knowledge to question that. Now that's changing with social media and the growing cannabis movement. But to your point, instead, one of the big issues with the VA is it's a government bureaucracy. Those government bureaucrats have very tight relationships, especially doctors, with industry. And what I mean by industry, I don't mean the hemp or marijuana industry. I mean pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the hospital industry. And there is a lot of money, $3.3 billion in pharmaceuticals alone at the VA being bought. There's a lot of bureaucrats looking for jobs in corporate America. There's a lot of doctors who get trips places because of pharmaceutical companies. So it's a very, very incestuous group of people from the VA to – it's just like lobbyists. It's just like your congressperson and all the lobbyists. They get their backs stroked. They get their wallets filled because they have access to these people. As enlisted soldiers, if I go into the VA, the access I have is I'll see a doctor for 10 minutes, right? And so what you have is a situation where the system is broken. The system isn't about saving money. The system is about perpetuating the system, first and foremost. And you do that by spreading a lot of your budget across people like pharmaceutical companies and so forth. And that's who's fighting this. They don't want cannabis. Because honestly, if we think about $3.3 billion in pharmaceuticals or a plant you can grow in your backyard.
Yeah, there's no question which one is more cost effective. And the vast majority of people who start using cannabis report that they have reduced or eliminated their use of pharmaceuticals.
No, absolutely. I mean, I went through the whole cocktail thing, and I also self-medicated with illicit drugs, mainly because they at least provided me some relief, more so than the crap I was taking from my private doctors and then the VA. And I will tell you 100% that cannabis works, and I've seen too many anecdotal people come forward, their wives, their spouses, male spouses, their kids. I mean, I can't tell you how many children, and I know some of the kids out there like Colton Turner and so forth who you talk to. My daughter said, marijuana gave me my dad back. And I hear that story across America. I hear it from parents who have kids in epileptic seizures who are saying it's giving my children such a better quality of life. I've, talked to old vets, Vietnam era vets who said, I've been doing it since the 60s, since the 70s and 60s when I got out, and it's helped me. And it is just horrible to hear all these wonderful anecdotal stories without the negative side that I hear with so many other, medications. And yet people are being arrested for it. You are getting in trouble for it at the VA. You're being stigmatized. I mean, there was just this child in middle America, and I forget where it happened, but it was in middle America somewhere that was stigmatized because he smelled of marijuana. And this was a straight-A honor roll student. And he got threatened, and what a horrible person he is, and his life is ruined. And this was just in the papers. And he ends up committing suicide. And these are the principals of schools and the parents of schools so scared because they've been raised in Nancy Reagan's ignorant just say no campaign. And, what we do is we are creating more damage than marijuana has ever caused by our war on the plant.
Yeah, absolutely, because you can't really make a war on a plant. You're really making war on the people that use the plant.
Absolutely.
And that's the people of the United States.
Absolutely. And if you look at the demographics, it was overlooked for so long because, listen, marijuana had a disproportionate demographic effect on, you know, inner cities, which were minority areas, and white middle America didn't really care, to be very honest with you. But now what we see with marijuana and such widespread use across the demographic movement, you know, we see that it's poverty that it hits, because those people are disproportionately, you know, harassed by the police, picked up on minor marijuana charges that stick with them, three-strike laws. So when you say it's a war on people, understand it's a war on poor people mostly.
Yeah, and there's another systemic issue there, and that poor people in general are more susceptible to the sorts of traumas and stresses that marijuana can relieve. So that more than likely, you know, they're self-medicating. And that's another reason I always say all use is medical. It's not there's no recreational use. Even if you're using it to relieve stress or something like that, it is still serving some medical benefit.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you talk about, I mean, when you're poor, you tend to be, you know, getting ground up by the system. And so, yeah, you would suspect that marijuana would be a higher used drug because of its access, its ease, and its symptom relief, which we all agree to. And so it would make sense, I would imagine. That totally makes sense.
There's something interesting, actually, that came up here at the conference. I noticed that they had a speaker here, a military guy, former Special Forces, talking about how the vast majority of the world prior to, you know, the 20th century, well, prior to about mid-century, really, they viewed Afghan soldiers as almost like the epitome of what it means to be a soldier. You know, they were fierce. They didn't back down, and there's a part of me that started to relate that phenomenon to the fact that Afghanistan is essentially the epicenter of cannabis in the world, and that cannabis use there is prevalent. And it would make sense that if their warriors actually use cannabis to ameliorate or completely block the symptoms of PTSD from ever occurring, they should be able to perform at a higher level in combat. It would make sense that we would give this to soldiers simply to improve their combat effectiveness.
Yeah, I don't know from a combat effectiveness. It's an interesting point. I mean, from a combat effectiveness, would marijuana... I mean, did you see the article that went around about the Medal of Honor winner in Vietnam that was awarded the Medal of Honor winner, who's now come out and said they had partied the night before and he was totally high during the attack from the Viet Cong, and that he fought off just wave after wave of Viet Cong, and they awarded him the Medal of Honor. He said he was high. So maybe there's something to that. I would, you know, I don't know if I'd want to be high on marijuana going in, but I sure would like access to it. I mean, listen, the soldiers have been using cannabis for thousands of years. If you look at Ulysses, I think it was Grant, and a few other presidents and ex-generals in the Civil War mentioned that every soldier, and I'm paraphrasing, every soldier should have cannabis in their rucksack. Because exactly, I mean, can you imagine after some of the issues you had in Afghanistan, if you had a joint in your back, you know, in your rucksack when you got back to patrol base or whatever? Yeah, you'd probably light up. It would probably take a lot of the nerve and therefore the trauma out of it. You know, it's interesting. People, I think one of the problems is we're dealing with people with limited experience. And what I mean by that is everyone likes to judge, and everyone likes to tell everyone else what they're doing. But I honestly, most people screaming from the top of the ceiling about this don't have a tremendous amount of life experience. For example, I would not let the ER doctor plan out my kids' school's recess and lunch activities. And what do I mean by that? I mean, I don't think, you know, I've had ER doctor friends come over and they don't allow their kids to do 90% of what most kids do on a daily basis for fear of injury or fear of something like a trampoline. You can't go on a trampoline because I see six people come in a week with bad broken bones from trampolines. And so what they do is put their kids in bubble wrap. And I think with drugs, we've scared everybody into really prohibiting what could be a very natural growth process, as you see in many other cultures, use of mind-expanding and altering drugs, especially in Central and South America and places like Afghanistan, is a very healthy part of their society. And because, what is it they say, marijuana is addicted to 6 to 8% of the population?
Yeah, actually less than what caffeine does.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the logic behind preventing anyone from using it and making it illegal? I mean, what is the harm what is the danger to society? And what we find out when you look at it, there really isn't much. And in fact, there's dangers to the war on marijuana, and those costs far outweigh any other issue. So it's just that we don't have an honest discussion. We have people in charge making laws whose very limited experience, or they're, you know, listen, it's like having a police officer as a family member. Their view of the world is going to be very different than, you know, other people's view because the people they deal with on a daily basis. Is it a good, accurate portrayal of society in general? I would say no, it's not. So I think we need to be careful who we listen to and why we're listening to them, from the financial incentive they have to spout their views and beliefs to understanding where they're coming from. And just like I would understand where the ER doctor is coming from when he talks about jumping on a trampoline, I think we need to start understanding when addiction specialists, doctors who see the worst of the worst on a daily basis, talk about how horrible these drugs are, and yet understand who and what they represent as a total percent of the population using them. And I think we allow those people to dictate, in many cases, because there's a ton of money to be made off prohibition, of which they're making a ton of money off it, right, that we need to think twice before enacting so many of these laws. We enact out of fear. And I think that explains a lot about the drug war in terms of why we allowed it to happen.
So before we get too far into this, I just want to revisit the Weed for Warriors, their upcoming projects now to push attention on the national level. What exactly is Weed for Warriors doing here? I understand coming up, you got a big event coming up in D.C. and across the nation.
Correct. We started the idea of throwing a tour a while ago, and honestly, it has been a last-minute push to get this done, and everyone's jumping on the board, and it's awesome. But we're leaving Los Angeles on October 17th. So this weekend, we're having a big run on Saturday from the Santa Monica Pier to Pacific Palisades Park. From 8 a.m. we start, so everyone come on out to the Santa Monica Pier. From there, we're going to Palisades Park, where we're going to be enjoying some lunch, some beer, probably some other medicines. And we'll end up, enjoying ourselves and enjoying our supporters. We then have a reception Saturday night, and then we leave. And we leave from Los Angeles, and we're heading to Denver. And our goal is we arrive in Denver on October 24th, and we'll probably arrive a couple days early, but that's when the festivities start. And we're going to be doing a lot of fun stuff. I mean, we're doing a cook-off.
Okay, hold on, Sean.
Go ahead.
You broke up a little bit there.
Okay.
Can you just go back over the Denver stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me start this whole thing over again, and we'll talk about the totality, and then we'll hit Denver because I know you guys specifically care about that. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. If anything breaks up, let me know.
Sean, I'm losing you.
Losing? Can you hear me?